Well, it's unfortunate, and you're correct. Election does have consequences. Clarence Thomas is a grifter. He is benefiting for positions that he actually benefited from. But for affirmative action, we would not know Clarence Thomas. But for desegregating society, we would not know Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas is an unfortunate outcome of a tradition of Black people grifting off their race to portray their race. And it's unfortunate. And what we've seen the Supreme Court do in the decision was to undermine the question of equal protection under the law, that no state should use race as a proxy to discriminate for political gain. We are living in America in 2024, not 1950s apartheid South Africa. And I believe this court want to create an apartheid system.
Yeah, I think they wish we were living in 1950s apartheid South Africa, including Clarence, who thinks somehow he might benefit from it, so long as he's some rich man's pet. Let me go to you, David Jolly. Let's talk about Samuel Alito. His contempt for his position, his blaming of his wife, his two coup flags, and then he is the author of a ruling which says, go ahead and discriminate as long as you color it as political discrimination, because really, he's fine with racial discrimination and gerrymandering.
Joy, I guess we give credit to Samuel Alito that he allows his wife to make her own decisions about which flag to fly, if not her own reproductive freedom. But that's between the Alitos, I suppose. Look, this issue on the gerrymandering decision that was made and all voting rights decisions that are considered by this court is really fascinating to me because of how quickly the Thomases and Alito will jump to the argument that racism is over, that there is no racism in the United States anymore, and therefore the protections against discriminated classes no longer need to be there. Look, all you have to do is go to certain political rallies tonight and you will see racism on display. But set that part aside as well, and to suggest that the discriminant impact of a history of racism in the United States is still not affecting opportunities for communities of color across the country tonight requires a professed ignorance of the facts right in front of their eyes. I mean, perhaps they live in some pretty special neighborhoods where they don't see the disparity in economic inequality. They don't see the access to healthcare inequality, the access to education inequality, to transportation, to jobs. It is there. And that discriminant impact is a result of centuries of racism in the United States, and there still is a role for the federal government. This court will not ever address it, and it's why, Joy, though I don't personally have a hard stance on this position, I think Democrats right now need to start talking more about expanding the court. Run on the issue of expanding the court, because the only way to dilute the power of the Alitos and Thomases now for the next several decades is to say we're a party that will expand the court and expand your freedoms.
Indeed. And I will note that Democrat Steve Cohen of Tennessee has introduced a bill calling to censure Samuel Alito for his coup flags. But Derek Johnson, I think the thing people, you know, I started this by saying elections matter, but I think people need to get their Democrats and just Americans in general, independents, Republicans who care about being a democracy, need to wrap their minds around the fact that if Donald Trump becomes president, Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas will immediately retire. They're both in their 70s. They want to retire under a Republican. We now know they are naked partisans. They're not jurists by any stretch of the imagination. They will retire and Donald Trump will replace them with 30-something and 40-something year old versions of themselves. Meaning Donald Trump will have appointed at that point 5 out of 9 members of the United States Supreme Court. He will have created a court that will last for 50 years or more. That is the legacy he will then inherit as somebody who did not win the popular vote the first time, who got a stolen court seat that he was allowed to flip after Justice Ginsburg died. This is insanity that people are even considering doing it. How do we get average citizens, Derek, to understand that that is what is at stake?
Well, I was in Detroit on Sunday, and I talked to a group of formerly incarcerated young men, and they were talking about their frustration, and I listened to them. And after they finished, I said, listen, in a two-party system, there isn't a third-party candidate option that's throwing away your vote. In the game of chess, it's not about the one election in November. It's about the power your vote means long-term. And as a result, you have to move away from candidate A versus candidate B. This is about fascism. or democracy. This is about your future. This is about the opportunity and the tone that you set in this power game. What we are looking at, unfortunately, is a small set of individuals that are highly funded by billionaires who are seeking to control tax policies, who get taxed, who's not, and what those tax dollars are spent on. And they're willing to risk our constitution and this democracy to maintain their supremacy.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll check you out next week. Take care.
Welcome to the show. In a shocking new poll, Kamala Harris leading Donald Trump nationally by 4 points as Donald Trump is collapsing and panicking daily, and J.D. Vance is losing 1 point of favorability every single day. What an incredible turn of events in American politics. Let's discuss it. In a new Civics Daily Kos poll, Kamala Harris is leading Donald Trump nationally 49-45. This is the best result for Kamala Harris so far. We will talk about how this fits into the average of polls, but what a number. Notable that among those 18-34, Kamala Harris is leading by more than 20 points. Among 35-49, she's leading by nearly 10 points. But among those 50 and older, that is the group with which Donald Trump continues to lead. A large majority of Democratic voters, 64% in this same poll, said they are glad that Biden decided to exit the 2024 presidential race. Only 11% of Democrats say they wish Biden were still running. These are incredible numbers. Now, the way that this has affected an average, you know, if we think about, we might think about the average of polls as a line and individual polling just as dots on that line, points on that line. If we take this Kamala plus four poll and average it into the national polling, what we see is that Trump's national lead has been reduced by 30% overnight as a result of a series of recent polls. So let's discuss that. You may recall that not long ago, Donald Trump was leading by 2%, 2.7%, roughly, as Joe Biden exited the race and in came Kamala Harris. And most recently, it was Trump plus two. Based on this new polling from Civics, as well as a number of other polls we will look at in a moment, Donald Trump's national lead is now 1.4. When you go from 2 to 1.4, you're reducing the lead by 0.6. That's 30%. That's a 30% reduction. Now, of course, these are small numbers, and we have to understand the limitations of changes in such small numbers. The Civics poll is not the only good poll for Kamala Harris. Where previously Trump was winning every poll, although some by only one, the last four polls are Kamala plus four, Trump plus four, Kamala plus one, that's Reuters Ipsos, and Kamala plus one in the morning consult poll. So forget about the details, zoom out. The two important takeaways are, anecdotally, there is a growing number of polls that have Kamala Harris in the lead. And as an average of polling, Trump's lead is now barely a single point. Now, later on in the show, we are going to do sort of a deeper dive into the paths to victory, because I know many of you are probably hearing me talk about national numbers and you're with tears in your eyes. You're saying, David, sir, I respect you so much. And I know that you're putting in the effort and doing the best you can. Most of you are thinking this, I'm sure. This is how what I think when I listen to podcasts. The host is doing such a good job. But we have an electoral college in the United States. Whether Kamala Harris wins or loses the popular vote by a few points, it's almost certainly going to come down to fewer than 500,000 votes in 3 to 5 critical swing states. And you would be completely correct. So later in the show, we are going to get into the electoral paths to victory, approval polling, and a whole bunch of other things. But by itself, stunning that we now are getting individual data points on the general polling line where Kamala Harris is winning by four. If this race continues to shift over the next 2 weeks, the way it has over the last 2 weeks, you could be talking about significant, statistically significant leads for Kamala Harris nationally. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about the other side of the coin, which is as Kamala Harris's stock continues to rise, J.D. Vance's shares are increasingly worthless. J.D. Vance is being considered the worst vice presidential pick dating back to 1972. That's like hundreds of years ago, it feels like. There is new approval polling for J.D. Vance that shows him losing a point of favorability every day over the last 10 days. These are insanely bad numbers. And this is why, when Trump was asked by Laura Ingraham, can you guarantee us that J.D. Vance was really a great pick? Trump had nothing to say other than he really likes family. When he was asked yesterday at the National Association of Black Journalists, is J.D. Vance ready to be president on day one as VP? Trump didn't say, yes, he is. He said something like he's a good guy or I've always respected him or something like that. It appears as though even Trump is struggling to justify this selection. So take a look at this. The important data here relates to the ABC News Ipsos poll. J.D. Vance, about 10 days ago, was a -6 in favorability. What favorability -6 means is that your unfavorability exceeds your favorability by 6 points. OK, about 10 days ago, J.D. Vance was at a -6. He is now at a -15. So let's do the math. In 10 days, he's lost 9 points, meaning with every day that goes by, with every day that J.D. Vance is out on the campaign trail, with every day that J.D. Vance is talking about childless cat ladies or videos and audio of J.D. Vance saying horrible things are unearthed, or Trump himself is unable to justify or even barely say anything positive about J.D. Vance, every single day that goes by, he is losing 1 point of favorability. An additional 1% of America, which is roughly 3.3 million people. Obviously, that includes kids, but as a general rule of thumb, 1% of America every day goes, I actually don't like this guy. I have an unfavorable view of him. I have a negative view of him. That's an absolute and total disaster. CNN's Harry Enten is calling Vance the worst pick since 1972, pointing to the childless cat lady comments and saying it's the worst vice presidential pick of my lifetime, which is really, really wild stuff. So where does this put us with regard to Trump's consideration of replacing J.D. Vance? I actually have no idea. There are rumors on both sides. Yesterday, Tim Miller told us that it would be relatively difficult, actually, at this point to do it from a political standpoint. There's no rule. I mean, you could do it. I got a bunch of emails from folks in the audience who said, oh, you know what? They're going to pull David. They are going to do the there is a health issue. J.D. Vance is having a health issue. I struggle to believe that. I struggle to believe that it would be credible. I don't think that that's going to be the situation. If there were to be a change to the VP running alongside Trump, I think it would be couched simply as Trump being Trump, making the difficult decisions, framing himself as the tough guy who's willing to go and say you're fired and just move on as quickly as they can. Sort of the way the Democratic Party has from Joe Biden's candidacy. But I don't expect some kind of convoluted illness situation. And there is also the growing aspect to this where I am no longer the only one. I was never the only one, but I am now seeing many others point to the very palpable and apparent discomfort and disengagement from Usha Vance, J.D. Vance's wife. And this is, of course, all speculative, circumstantial and anecdotal. But we are seeing a lot of these data points. She previously expressed being appalled by Trump in private communications. It's very hard to imagine even the most craven and naked thirst for power, which being VP certainly gives you. It's hard to imagine that really changing her perspective on Trump. So put aside for a second that J.D. Vance almost certainly still thinks of Trump as a doofus as he used to. Usha Vance really seems to dislike the guy. at a recent campaign stop, a staged campaign event at a diner in Minnesota. She looked genuinely miserable. In recent images from her on the campaign plane, seeming completely disengaged, just reading a book as conversations are going on around her. Now, you could say, you know, pictures rather than video don't represent the full story. Anything could have been going on. Absolutely. It is a speculative sort of narrative that we are trying to build up from individual bullet points. But if I had to guess, Usha Vance is not happy with what's going on. She's not enjoying this. She doesn't like the idea of her husband being so closely associated with a guy that she finds appalling. So all of this points to trouble in paradise. Whether it leads to the replacement of J.D. Vance, I have absolutely no idea. I want to hear from you. Does Trump replace J.D. Vance? info@davidpakman.com. We'll take a very quick break and be right back. Donald Trump got absolutely crushed yesterday during an interview at the National Association of Black Journalists event. Now, a lot of people are saying, David, why is the race card being played? Why are people talking about black interviewer Rachel Scott and black interviewer Harris Faulkner? It sounds like you liberals are playing the race card. Well, it matters because this was an event at the National Association of Black Journalists. The entire context here is one where, despite claims from Trump that black Americans are flocking to him, in a recent Michigan poll, Trump got 0% of the black vote. It is highly politically relevant that this is an audience made up of black journalists. And the first question was absolutely wild. Trump hated it, and it only went downhill from here.
Mr. President, we so appreciate you giving us an hour of your time. I want to start by addressing the elephant in the room, sir. A lot of people did not think it was appropriate for you to be here today. You have pushed false claims about some of your rivals.
This is like brutal right up the, off the bat.
From Nikki Haley to former President Barack Obama, saying that they were not born in the United States, which is not true. You have told four congresswomen of color who were American citizens to go back to where they came from. You have used words like animal and rabid to describe black district attorneys. You've had dinner with a white supremacist at your Mar-a-Lago resort. So my question, sir, now that you are asking black supporters to vote for you, why should black voters trust you after you have used language like that?
Well, first of all, I don't think I've ever been asked a question so in such a horrible manner, first question.
The crowd is already like, what on earth? This is going wrong instantly. He just opened his mouth.
Say hello, how are you? Are you with ABC? Because I think they're a fake news network, a terrible network. And I think it's disgraceful that I came here in good spirit. I love the black population of this country. I've done so much for the black population of this country.
The crowd is in disbelief at what's happening.
Including employment, including opportunity zones with Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina.
It is beyond belief that this went so poorly. Now, there are right wingers cheering this and saying he stepped into the lion's den and he did so well. I don't think so. If you watch the whole thing, I certainly don't think so. He continues to attack the interviewer.
If I came onto a stage like this and I got treated so rudely as this woman treated me.
Oh, my goodness.
This woman. Wow.
Treated so rudely as this woman treated
me. Oh, my goodness.
And I'm fine with it because she was very rude, sir. Very rude. That was a nasty. That wasn't a question. She
sir,
didn't ask me a question.
Question.
She gave a statement. That wasn't a question.
I repeated your statement, sir, actually.
It was nasty to read my own statements back to me. And it only got worse from here. The topic of the January 6th rioters came up. Trump asked, would you pardon them? And he goes, sure, if they're innocent. To which Rachel Scott points out, well, they are definitionally not innocent because they've been convicted. And Trump's like, ah, well.
Portland that destroyed.
But sir, my
that
question
city.
Is on those.
What's going to happen to
my
the
question
people
is
that
on
tried
those
to
rioters who assaulted
Excuse
officers?
Me. You have to
would
ask,
you pardon
what's
those?
What's
going to
happen? Oh, absolutely, I would.
You
if
would
they're
pardon
innocent,
those?
If they're innocent, I would pardon them.
They've been convicted.
And by the way, the Supreme Court just under. Well, they were convicted by a very tough system. They were. How come the people that tried to burn down Minneapolis. How come the people that took over a large percentage of Seattle, how come nothing happened to them? How come the people
that... But, sir,
we're
talking about people that were seen beating officers with
flagpoles,
dragging them down the stairs. They're on video. Have you seen that video, sir?
Oh, really? Well, they
shot... You would pardon those rioters?
They shot a young lady in the face who was protesting. They shot her in the face. You know, nobody died that day. You do know that. But people died in Seattle. Nobody died, but people died in Minneapolis. Do you know people died in Minneapolis? And nothing happens, and nobody ever talks, and nothing happens to those people. But you went after the J6 people with a vengeance. And I'll tell you what about the cops that were, and I'm all for the police, as you know, but what about the police that are ushering everybody into the Capitol?
So this is not a great answer if you're on the side of law and order. And it was all like this, either tangential non-responses or attacks on the interviewers. Trump asked, is J.D. Vance ready on day one to be president of the United States? He would be a heartbeat away from the presidency as your vice president. And Trump basically says VPs don't matter. I mean, this is part of why we're wondering, is he done with Vance? Because every opportunity he gets to defend J.D., he's kind of like, I don't know, he's a good guy. I respect him, but it doesn't even really matter.
And that's why this decision is important this time. Bad things happen. You said it twice. When you look at J.D. Vance, is he ready on day one?
Does he what?
Ready on day one, if he has to be.
I've always had great respect for him and for the other candidates, too. But I will say this, and I think this is well documented. Historically, the vice president in terms of the election does not have any impact. I mean,
can you imagine? For everybody really worried that I picked a doofus, it's completely irrelevant who I pick.
Virtually no impact. You have two or three days where there's a lot of commotion as to who, like you're having it on the Democrat side, who it's going to be. And then that dies down and it's all about the presidential pick. Virtually never has it mattered. Maybe Lyndon Johnson mattered for different reasons than what we're talking about, not for vote reasons, but for political reasons, other political reasons. But historically, the choice of a vice president makes no difference.
It's amazing. Could you defend your choice? Have you selected someone who could actually be president? It's completely irrelevant. What a ringing endorsement. My VP pick is completely irrelevant. Now, maybe most relevant to what's going on with J.D. Vance. Trump says he didn't know about J.D. Vance's childless cat lady comments when he selected him as the VP, and that it's not something he even agrees with.
He said the Democrats running the country are a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices they've made. And so they want to make the rest of the country miserable, too. He's not talking here about how great it is to be a parent. He's attacking what he says are the choices people are making to not have children. Did you know that he had these views about people who do not have children before you picked him to be your running mate? And do you agree with him?
No, I know this. He is very family oriented and he thinks family is a great thing. That doesn't mean he thinks that if you don't have a family, it's not. I know people with families. I know people with great families. I know people with very troubled families. And I also know people with no families. They didn't meet the right person. Things happen. You go through life, you don't meet the right person.
But he's not just talking about families here.
And
he also
some
says
of those
that people that don't have children should get less votes than those
right.
that do.
I'm just speaking for myself.
Is that your
and
campaign
I think
position?
I'm speaking for him, too. He strongly believes in family. But I know people with great families. I know people
having to defend the crazy things that your VP running mate is going around saying is not a positive thing for your campaign.
With not great families that don't have a family, and the people without the family are far better. They're superior in many cases. OK, he's not saying they're not. What he's saying is that he thinks the family experience is a very important thing. It's a very good thing. But that doesn't mean that if you grow up and you grow older and you don't meet somebody that would be wonderful to meet and would have been good, that's a bad thing. He's not saying that.
He kind of is.
You'll have to ask him, actually. But my interpretation is he's strongly family-oriented. But that doesn't mean if you don't have a family, there's something wrong with it.
Just one last point, and then we'll move on. Just one of the bedrock principles of American life is one person, one vote. Senator J.D. Vance has suggested that someone who has children should have more votes than a person who does not have children. I just want to be clear here. Is that the position of your campaign?
Well, no, but it's not something I have ever heard before.
No, it's not something Trump believes, but he's kind of playing coy and is like, I don't know if Diddy Vance really actually said that. Trump then trying to attack Kamala Harris. But it's like these attacks are like nothing. These are just totally flaccid attacks saying, you know, she didn't pass her bar exam the first time. She might fail a cognitive test. That Trump wants the cognitive test up against Kamala Harris seems very dumb.
I said, Joe and I will go and take a cognitive test. Now, I'd do it with her, too. I would do it with her also. You know what? She failed her law exam. She didn't pass her law exam, so maybe she wouldn't pass the cognitive test.
Mr. President,
are you saying she wouldn't pass? Just to be clear,
I'm just giving you the facts.
To be clear, you don't think Harris.
How do you intend? And
she didn't pass her bar exam, and she didn't think she would pass it, and she didn't think she was going to ever pass it. And I don't know what happened. Maybe she passed it.
She did pass it.
There's a man over here.
Yeah, I don't know that cognitive tests are what he wants to do against Kamala Harris. And then finally, and we'll get to Kamala became black. That was so crazy, it deserves its own segment. Finally, this completely bizarre interview ends with barely any applause and Trump just kind of getting up and walking away.
And remember, they're taking your jobs. These people coming in are taking your jobs.
Project 2025.
I think we have to leave it there the Trump team.
All right.
So leave it. That is the last word. Thank you so much, Mr. Trump, for coming today and joining us.
The audience is just in disbelief.
What? Well, thank you very much.
What? They've been telling us.
Thank you, everybody, very much. Great
thank
honor.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
NABJ will email about details regarding the conversation with Vice President Kamala Harris in September. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, man. What? So I had a feeling this could go wrong, but it went way more wrong. You know, I don't know that this is going to push up Trump's black support in Michigan from the zero where it was found to be last week. I don't know that he really achieved that. And then now we are going to look at maybe the wildest moment from the entire thing. I've never seen anything like this. The audience at Trump's interview with the National Association of Black Journalists audibly gasps when Trump says that Indian Kamala Harris turned black. She became black. I saw the headlines before I saw the video, and I said to myself, there is no way Trump would be so stupid to go to the NABJ after polling zero among black Americans in Michigan and say something this ridiculous. But then we saw the video. Let's play it with a little bit of lead up. Unbelievable. And the crowd audibly gasping.
Follow up, sir, and then we'll move on to other questions here. Some of your own supporters, including Republicans on Capitol Hill, have labeled Vice President Kamala Harris, who is the first black and Asian American woman to serve as vice president and be on a major party ticket, as a DEI hire. Is that acceptable language to you? And will you tell those Republicans and those supporters to stop it?
How do you define DEI? Go ahead. How do you define
diversity, equity, inclusion?
Okay, yeah, go ahead. Is that what your definition?
Give
me a definition
the
then. Would you give me a definition
DEI.
Of that? Give me a definition.
Sir,
of
I'm
that.
Asking you a question.
No, you
a
have
very
to define
question.
It. Define it for me, if you will.
I just defined it, sir. Do you believe that Vice President Kamala Harris is only on the ticket because she is a black woman?
Well, I can say no. I think it's maybe a little bit different. So, I've known her a long time indirectly, not directly very much, and she was always of Indian heritage, and she was only promoting Indian heritage. I didn't know she was black until a number of years ago when she happened to turn black, and now she wants to be known as black. So I don't know, is she Indian or is she black?
She has always
but
identified
you know
as a black woman.
I respect
she went to a historically
either
black
one.
College.
I respect either one, but she obviously doesn't, because she was Indian all the way, and then all of a sudden she made a turn, and she went, she became a black person.
Just to be clear, sir, do
and
you
I
believe
think,
that
I think
she...
This guy's out of his mind. You know, I don't even know if there is value in talking about the substance here, because as many of you may know, Kamala Harris is half Indian, half Jamaican. And when I was younger and worked at Circuit City, I've mentioned before that I had a Jamaican manager, and he would always say he doesn't consider he says, I'm not African-American. And that's what people mean when they say black. So I just tell people I'm not black. Now, there's a lot of history and scholarship around this. In a strict sense, Jamaicans are not African American, they're Afro-Caribbean. Now, some people use black interchangeably with African American. In that sense, if you're Jamaican, you're not black. But at the same time, for many people, black is broader and it just means anyone of African descent. So you could be African American, you could be Afro-Caribbean, you could be Afro-Cuban, which would be a specific Afro-Caribbean, or some people say, well, Cuba's not really in the Caribbean. Anybody with African descent, or folks in Brazil of African descent are black, but they certainly aren't African American in the sense that they're not American from the United States. So there is a conversation there, but that's not what Trump is talking about. I don't know that we really need to focus on that, because what Trump's talking about is just the idea that, similar to how he has criticized Elizabeth Warren, that Kamala Harris is calculating when to play up which identity in a way that is nakedly political and cynical and craven or whatever. And I think that that's what this is really about. And as a side note, there is a serious media double standard here, because think about the weeks and thousands of stories of what we got after Joe Biden's bad debate performance. This is insane. What Trump said here is absolutely insane. And I assume it's gone from the news cycle, certainly by Monday, if not by this weekend. And so there is a serious double standard there. But this is just completely whacked. And as far as Kamala Harris goes, you know, there are, I mean, listen, I'm Jewish and I'm Hispanic, right? I mean, I'm a Jewish individual. And sometimes I talk about anti-Semitism. And when I talk about anti-Semitism, me being Hispanic and from Argentina doesn't really relate to the subject matter. So sometimes people accuse me of playing up. Look at the YouTube comments. I play up my Jewish identity when it's convenient, and I ignore the fact that I'm actually really Hispanic. And then similarly, sometimes when we talk about the voting patterns of Central and South Americans, I talk about my family background from Argentina. And then people show up in the comments and they go, I thought you were Jewish. You're just doing... This is a common criticism from the right that's used to invalidate people based on identity. And I don't know that we should really play into it, is where I land. But what a whacked thing to say. Kamala Harris, speaking in Houston yesterday, she addressed Donald Trump's completely whacked out comment that she used to be Indian, but she became black, which Trump said during an interview at the NABJ, the National Association of Black Journalists Conference. I think Kamala Harris does a couple of really good things here. And one of the things is she doesn't repeat exactly what Donald Trump said. And number two, she doesn't directly engage with the substance in trying to defend her identity. She just points out how absolutely pathetic Trump's comments are. I think this is very smart. Let's take a listen.
We all here remember what those 4 years were like. And today we were given yet another reminder. This afternoon... Donald Trump spoke at the annual meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists. And it was the same old show. The divisiveness and the disrespect. And let me just say, the American people deserve better. The American people deserve better. The American people deserve a leader who tells the truth, a leader who does not respond with hostility and anger when confronted with the facts. We deserve a leader who understands that our differences do not divide us. They are an essential source of our strength. So I say, to Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated, ours is a fight for the future.
I think this is super smart. She's not going up there and saying, did you hear that Trump said, and quoting him? She's not going up there and saying, as many of you know, I am the daughter of an Indian mother, and a Jamaican father and my identity and intersectionality. She's not doing that. And I think that's smart because you're starting to play the game. And that's where others have fallen flat. She's rising above it and saying, this is the kind of garbage that we saw from Trump last time. This is what we are going to continue to see. It's not what the country needs. It's beneath us. I'm not even going to get down in the mud. Now, there's an argument for getting down in the mud that some will make. And on some issues, in some cases, I think that makes sense. Here it doesn't. I think Kamala Harris handled this absolutely perfectly. Let me know what you think. info@davidpakman.com. Let's take a deeper dive into how Kamala Harris replacing Joe Biden as the presumptive Democratic presidential nominee has completely upended this race. It's now been almost 2 weeks since Joe Biden dropped out, endorsed Kamala Harris, who secured enough delegate endorsements to become the presumptive nominee, also raising record amounts of money, $200 million in the first week of her campaign. Importantly, two thirds of which came from first time donors, meaning people who were not previously donors to Joe Biden. Harris also raised $81 million the day after Joe Biden announced his decision. That's the highest 24-hour fundraising haul of any presidential candidate in history. And in a sense, Kamala Harris has revitalized the Democratic Party. The momentum behind Harris is real, and it's a real contrast to Joe Biden, who two-thirds of Democrats wanted to see drop out of the race. But the question is, can Kamala Harris maintain her momentum? And maybe more importantly, can she defeat Donald Trump in November? So far, the answer is not totally clear. Let's start with how Joe Biden was polling against Trump prior to exiting the race. Then we'll look at Kamala's early polling. According to the Real Clear Politics average, as of July 16th, Biden was losing every critical swing state that delivered him victory in 2020, losing Arizona by 5.8, losing Georgia by 3.8, losing Wisconsin by 2.9, losing Michigan by 2.1, losing Nevada by 5%, losing Pennsylvania by 3.8. Given that the Electoral College exists, we have to remember that swing state polling is a really important indicator of who's likely to win the election in November. In every swing state where Biden was losing to Trump, the same polling shows down ballot Senate candidates defeating their MAGA opponents by substantial margins. This includes Ruben Gallego, Jackie Rosen, Tammy Baldwin. When I reported on this in an editorial, many in the audience were upset with me, saying the polls are all wrong and Biden is actually ahead. But apparently the polling was convincing enough to Biden himself, because as Politico reports, on the eve of his decision to exit the race, Joe Biden's aides showed him internal polling, which showed his lead collapsing in the swing states, also in New Mexico and Virginia. So where does this leave Kamala Harris today? Well, the polling on Kamala versus Trump is limited. Her campaign just started, but there are some early indicators that we can look at. Remember that Kamala's fundraising has been incredible, literally record breaking, and that serves as an important proxy to enthusiasm. But before dropping out of the race, Joe Biden's approval was one of the lowest of his presidency at 38%. According to 538 as of July 30th, Kamala's approval rating is not that much higher than Biden's at just 39.6. But in a morning consult poll conducted more recently, Kamala Harris has 50% favorability. That's much better. At this point in her campaign, Kamala's fundraising may be a stronger barometer of her favorability than what 538 or morning consults say, but this is still subject to change. But what about the swing states we reviewed earlier? The reason swing state polling matters is a candidate can win the popular vote, but lose the Electoral College, which often depends on just a handful of critical swing states. Now, the swing state polling looks much better for Kamala Harris than it did for Joe Biden. According to the Real Clear Politics average, as of July 28th, Kamala Harris has gained ground in all of the swing states where Biden was losing to Trump. In Arizona, Trump is ahead by about 4, down from about 6. In Georgia, Trump is ahead by 3.6 instead of 3.8. In Wisconsin, Trump is ahead by just 0.2%, down from almost 3%. In Michigan, Kamala Harris is now leading by 2, where Trump led Biden by 2. In Nevada, Trump's ahead by 4, down from 5. And in Pennsylvania, Trump is ahead by 2.7, down from 3.8. Some of the polls included in these Real Clear Politics averages were actually conducted prior to Joe Biden dropping out. So if anything, these are conservative estimates of where Kamala currently stands in this matchup against Donald Trump. Now, additionally, you can find more recent individual polls that are more optimistic for Harris. We've talked about some of them. According to a Bloomberg Morning Consult poll done from July 24 to 28, Kamala is leading Trump in Michigan by 11 and leading by 2 in Arizona, Wisconsin, and Nevada. Trump is ahead of Harris by 4 in Pennsylvania and 2 in North Carolina, and Georgia is a toss-up. We also have polling from Emerson conducted between July 22nd and 23rd, which finds Trump is still ahead in Arizona by 5, ahead in Georgia by 2, Michigan by 1, and Pennsylvania by 2, with Wisconsin as a toss-up. So the takeaway is Kamala Harris's campaign has only just started, and the numbers show at minimum Harris is competitive and has the potential to gain even more ground after the DNC and after debates, if there are any, if Trump agrees to debate her. So let's now talk about the specific path to victory for Kamala Harris. There are actually a few paths electorally which could deliver Kamala Harris the 270 electoral votes she needs to become president. The first and most likely path would be to win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. We're putting up the map of what that would look like. If Kamala Harris wins Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, but loses Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina, it's a razor-thin margin, but she would win the presidency and defeat Donald Trump. Now, there's a second path to victory, which is called the Sunbelt path, where Kamala wins Nevada, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina. Here's what the map would look like in that circumstance. And based on what we're seeing in the polling today, it's unlikely that Kamala will lose all three states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. But the point is, even if she does, there is still a path to the presidency for her. Now, a third path for Kamala Harris is winning Wisconsin, Michigan, Georgia, and North Carolina, but losing Arizona, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. Here's the map in that scenario. And then a very interesting scenario that could come up if Kamala wins Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, but loses Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, and the Omaha district in Nebraska, is a 269-269 tie. Now, this is not a good scenario for Kamala Harris, because in this scenario, there would be a contingent election in the House where Trump almost certainly wins, because Republicans almost always have more House delegations. That makes it a scary scenario, and it just reinforces the importance of winning that Omaha district in Nebraska. Here's what the map would look like in those circumstances. So the main takeaway here is that Kamala Harris has multiple paths to victory, whereas based on what the polling told us about President Biden, he needed to win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania to get a second term, because he seemed so far behind in Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada. So there are also other early indicators that Kamala Harris is a formidable opponent to Donald Trump. There's a Fox News poll conducted July 22nd to 24th, which finds that Kamala Harris's approval rating has surpassed Trump's in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Minnesota. That's a good sign. According to ABC News Ipsos polling, Democrats are now more enthusiastic about Kamala Harris than Republicans currently are about Trump. You might recall that previously, Republicans were more excited about Trump than Democrats were about Biden. That's an optimistic change. And then there's a CNN survey that shows Harris with a 4-point lead over Trump among registered voters 18 to 34. That's an 11-point improvement compared to Joe Biden. There's also an Axios poll finding that Kamala Harris is more popular with voters 18 to 34 than Biden was, and that they are even more likely to vote for her. So these are promising signs for Kamala Harris. But even though she seems to have the momentum, it's very much unclear who's going to win. Trump could very well win a second term. This will almost certainly be a close race. We should not get complacent. Even Kamala herself has acknowledged she's the underdog in this race, and that's probably true. Even if the polling showed Kamala Harris winning every single swing state by a wide margin, which it does not, show that. But even if it did, we should still behave as if Kamala Harris were behind, and we should be campaigning and acting accordingly. It's great that the data suggests Harris has improved relations with that 18 to 34 demographic. But the Harris campaign should not take those votes for granted, especially when it comes to policy. Kamala Harris should run on at least 2 to 3 bold, popular, progressive policies and viciously go after Donald Trump. Her rhetoric on Trump has been very strong. She's opened speeches and rallies saying she's seen Donald Trump's type because she spent so long prosecuting criminals and fraudsters and sexual predators. The contrast between the prosecutor and the convicted felon is a striking contrast. And it also neutralizes the Republican attack on Democrats as being soft on crime, which Republicans love to play up. Trump represents the threat to democracy. And the Harris campaign needs to offer something for people to vote for, not just vote against Trump. And so far, Kamala Harris, as of this moment, does not have any policies listed on her website. But in listening to her speeches and rallies, it's clear she will make reproductive freedom a central campaign issue. That's good, but it should be expanded. The policy discussion should go beyond that. Talk about legislation that she co-sponsored as a senator. For example, Harris co-sponsored Bernie Sanders' free college legislation. Harris co-sponsored the Green New Deal legislation with AOC. And as a presidential candidate in 2020, she pitched this $10 trillion climate plan, whose public and private investments would have dwarfed the $1.6 trillion estimated cost of Biden's major climate, energy, infrastructure and tech legislation. As a senator, Harris proposed sweeping tax cuts for the middle class through the LIFT Act, which would have provided an annual tax credit of up to $3,000 per person or $6,000 per couple for lower and middle income workers on top of any benefits they already receive. So these are just a few ideas that could appeal to progressives. We should not underestimate Trump. He can absolutely win a second term, and we should do everything we can to prevent that from happening. But we also shouldn't underestimate Kamala Harris. She can absolutely win this as well. When she first ran for president in 2020, polling for her peaked at 15% after the first primary debate, which was impressive for a relatively less known politician in the same race as established figures like Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. But you might recall that her polling slipped when she went moderate, when she dropped her support for Medicare for All, when she dropped the other flagship progressive policies. So if her 2020 campaign is an indication of how she can win 2024, she should position herself to the left of Joe Biden, but to the right of Bernie Sanders. This is not saying what are my politics. This is saying strategically what positioning makes the most sense. Now, there are still 3 months to go until the election. That's a very long time in politics. A lot will happen between now and then. Kamala's running mate, the DNC, maybe debating Trump. All of these are opportunities for Kamala Harris to improve swing state polling even more. The attacks on Kamala from Republicans so far have fallen pretty flat. They've tried attacking her for her laughing Kamala, the cackle. It hasn't really worked in Trump's favor. It's really only highlighted that Trump rarely laughs and doesn't seem to understand humor. If anything, it's humanized Kamala Harris. They've tried attacking Kamala Harris's handling of the border, probably more effective than making fun of her laugh, but also weak in light of the fact that Trump blocked the Biden administration and Congress from passing a bipartisan border bill, which would have restored Remain in Mexico and much of what Trump advocates for. So based on everything we've seen so far, it looks like making Kamala Harris the nominee rather than Joe Biden has been the right call. We don't have all of the information, including November's results, but polling, fundraising, the implosion of Trump's attacks on the Democrat, presumptive Democratic nominee, all of these are positively pointing signs. Now what we need to do is vote, donate if we can, phone bank if we can, and see what happens in November. Well, after his disastrous appearance with the National Association of Black Journalists, Donald Trump showed up at a rally in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, bloated, swollen, orange, slurring, and visibly disoriented, and silenced the crowd. You could hear a pin drop during most of this rally as he ranted, raved, and suffered a bunch of nuclear glitches. And this is a very rapid decline that we are seeing. Here is Donald Trump with his new line about how Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer has become a Palestinian member of Hamas. Silent. The crowd is silent. He's losing them, folks.
In line, Chuck Schumer refused to shake the Israeli prime minister's hand. Chuck Schumer has become a Palestinian. Yes. Can you believe it? He's become a proud member of Hamas. Nancy Pelosi likewise denounced the speech in shameful terms.
Completely and totally deranged. And it's gotten so, I hate to use the term weird, but it's gotten so weird that even his crowd is like, this is some weird you know what. Now, there was a moment when Trump's crowd finally perked up, which is when Trump started pushing the transphobia.
On day one, I will sign a new executive order to cut federal funding for any school pushing critical race theory, transgender insanity, and other inappropriate racial, sexual, or political content.
That fires them up.
Onto the lives of our children. And I will not give one penny to any school that has a vaccine mandate or a mask mandate.
As I've said before, every public school has vaccine requirements. And this just means Trump will stop funding public education, which, by the way, many Republicans want to do. Trump issuing some of the usual threats that he issued about Joe Biden's forthcoming presidency in 2020. Now about Kamala Harris. The country is over if we have a president Kamala Harris.
I think worse than Biden, and he's gone, he's shot. But if she becomes your president, our country is finished, I'll tell you. And Pennsylvania, your beautiful commonwealth, it's always good when you remember it's a commonwealth. He would call it a state often. Remember when Biden used, I used to love this guy, because you were on pins and needles watching him speak. You know, when's he gonna blow it? And it would always happen. I think worse than Biden.
None of this is sounding like Trump is particularly coherent for a guy who's focusing only on Joe Biden. And that in another point in the speech, Trump, speaking to a completely silent crowd, talking about the cognitive stuff and saying, hey, you know what? They're going after me for talking about Hannibal Lecter. That's not really a problem. And the crowd is weirded out.
Is a step above, right? This is, oh, they go crazy when they want to try and say, he's cognitively impaired. You know, I stand up here for 2 hours and I speak without a mistake. But when I say Hannibal Lecter, they say, why does he keep mentioning it? Because Hannibal Lecter was a serious psycho, right? He was Silence of the Lambs. Dr. Hannibal Lecter, he'd like to have you for dinner. See the man with the wall? Stand up. Look at this guy. He's here so much. He's great. He's great.
I'm guessing Trump's pointing to brick suit guy who we've interviewed. That's my guess here.
He's a Trump voter. I don't think we have to worry about him, do we? He's a Trump voter all the way. But Hannibal Lecter would like to have you for dinner.
All right. So not normal. Not normal at all. Trump also talking about Kamala Harris being beautiful or her name being beautiful. It just is degenerating into stream of consciousness nonsense.
I can't believe I'm doing it. You know, the weird thing. I mean, 2 weeks ago, I was talking about Biden. I didn't even know her name. Nobody did. Kamala. Hello. Beautiful. I didn't even know her name. Kamala.
Oh, I guess he's saying someone in the audience is beautiful. I don't know. It's all very much jumping from one thing to another. At another moment during the speech, Trump pulls out these lurid anecdotes involving migrant crimes that he likes to hold up as evidence of something. And the crowd really isn't into it. I don't know how else to say it. They're just kind of like bored by the whole
thing. Every single day you read about one of these horrible monsters from parts unknown who raped a young girl, killed her, cut him up, uses knives, not guns, because it's a slower death. These are monsters, and we have them.
The audience seems bored to tears.
In our country, and we're going to deport them at a level like nobody's ever seen. We're going to get them the hell out of our country.
There you go.
Go back to the country from which they came.
That roused them. Okay, we're going to start mass deportations of people. Some glitches and slurring from Trump talking about the nation's congrate. I don't know.
Just Chicago and the whole nation's congrate. Crime rate. Look.
Crime rate, he meant. The congrate was actually the crime rate. And then as the speech continued, just slurring more and more and more, talking about MASH and stuff like that.
And then radical Islamic terrorists. She backs mass amnesty. Mass amnesty and citizenship.
Mask amnesty. If you are not wearing a mask, we will grant you amnesty.
For all illegals, she supports mandatory gun confiscation. Would anybody...
Confiscation. Yeah, so Trump really struggling to get through this one. And finally, all of a sudden, Biden isn't too old to be president. That's not the issue. And of course, the reason Trump is talking about this is that he's basically as old as Joe Biden. And now the contrast is Trump and 59-year-old Kamala Harris. Trump now seems like the old guy. Trump now will be the oldest presidential nominee in American history. So Trump's new line has to be, the issue is not that Biden is old.
You know, 81 is not old. I have friends that are 95 that are still. Bernie Marcus, founder of Home Depot, 95 years old, still sharp, still sharp. I spoke to him the other day. I said, I think you're smarter now than you were 30 years ago. I don't know what's going on. I said, what's going on? It's working every 81 is not old. And but he's different. He's a bad 81. He's a bad 81.
There you go. So this is very different than what Trump said 2 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, Biden was too old. MAGA World was saying Biden's simply too old. Trump at 2.5 years younger is the right age. Now compared to 59-year-old Kamala Harris, who has the energy, who has the speaking ability, who has extraordinary energy at rallies, who is just dumping in gobs of money and fundraising. Now, all of a sudden, 81's fine as long as you're sharp. And by the way, I'm 79 or 78, however old Trump is, and I'm very sharp as well. The problem's just Biden's sharpness. A very different story when he now officially is the oldest presidential nominee in American history. Here's my question for you. Do you expect this to continue declining as we get closer and closer to November? Or do you believe that this is about as bad as it's going to get? Let me know. info@davidpakman.com. Make sure you're subscribed to the YouTube channel. It's free. Just hit the subscribe button. We're pushing to 2.5 million subscribers. We went from 2.2 to 2.3 million yesterday. Can you believe what's happening? Let's get to the 2.5 million. And we have a fantastic bonus show for you today. We are going to dive deep into why the weird allegation about Trump and Vance is working. Why is it working? We will talk about Twitter suspending the White Dudes for Harris account after that major fundraiser. And we will also talk about Illinois banning companies from forcing workers to listen to anti-union talk. I'll tell you about, at a former job of mine, the anti-union videos I was subjected to. All of those stories and more on today's bonus show. Sign up at joinpacman.com, get instant access, and I will see you on the bonus show, and we'll have a new show for you tomorrow.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio, this is In Black America.
It really surprised me that she was a quiet warrior. You know, we're so used to our activists being loud and proud and power to the people, but Hattie was a quiet warrior. She brought about change because she had a seat at the table. For example, there are things that didn't make it into the movie, derogatory things that didn't make it into the Gone with the Wind movie, because Hattie McDaniel had them change. And she was able to do that because she had a seat at the table. And she was often criticized because people felt she wasn't doing enough for blacks. But so I was really surprised to see that, you know, the changes she was making. I also was stunned at the hate that she got from both sides. White people didn't like her because they thought Mammy was too sassy. Black people didn't like her because they thought she was too demeaning. And the NAACP waged an all-out war against her. So that really shocked me as well.
Rashonda Tate, screenwriter, movie producer, award-winning, and best-selling author. Her latest book is entitled The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel, published by HarperCollins Publishers. One would have thought after becoming the first African-American to win an Oscar for a role in the iconic film Gone with the Wind, Hattie McDaniel's career had reached the pinnacle for which she had worked so hard. But months after winning the award, not only did the Oscar curse set in where she couldn't find work, but she found herself thrust in the middle of two worlds, black and white, and not being welcome in either one. Whites only saw her as Mammy, and black detested the demeaning portrayal. As the NAACP waged an all-out war against her, she continued to fight to pave a path for other black actors, fighting housing discrimination and navigating four failed marriages. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, The Queen of Sugar Hill, a novel of Hattie McDaniel with Rashonda Tate, In Black America.
You know, it's really just about her place in history. In her Academy Awards speech, she says that she wanted to always be a credit to her race. And I think for so long, that was lost. And what I'm hoping this book does is help reshine that light on her, as well as introduce her to a whole generation of people who just may not even know about her or may not know the extent of her contributions to our world. I have a 16-year-old son who had never heard of her. And even when I began this process, kept calling her Hattie LaBelle. But when I finally got him to understand, he was just like, wow, why don't I know anything about her? And I said, well, that's what we're hoping to change.
In her latest work, The Queen of Sugar Hill, author Rashonda Tate presents a fictional portrait of Hattie McDaniel, one of Hollywood's most prolific but woefully unappreciated stars, and the first African-American ever to win an Oscar in 1940 for a role as Mammy in the film classic Gone with the Wind. The award was supposed to be a game changer, a life-changing moment. It was, but not what McDaniel envisioned. Little did she know, that triumph would be followed by a series of challenges that would test her resilience and determination. Despite winning the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress, that historic win didn't create greater opportunities for her career. She went on to portray more amazing films, accepting at least 74 maid roles, with Mammy being her most famous performance. Earning credit for all her hard work was also a problem. Although the actor appeared in more than 300 films, she received film credit for only 83. Recently in Black America, spoke with author Rashonda Tate.
Yes, yes. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to begin with the questions that I asked you before we went on air. How has the tour been thus far on the book tour?
It's wonderful. I am just amazed at all the people that are coming out. Great crowds, great talking to people, and just enlightening and educating people. So it's wonderful.
What made you want to write about Hattie McDaniel?
My grandmother loved Gone with the Wind. I did not. I didn't like Hattie McDaniel because I felt she was portraying this demeaning stereotype. And my grandmother said, so you don't like her playing a maid, but I am a maid. So why are you looking at her with disdain? And by the way, it's 1939. What did you expect her to play, Scarlett O'Hara? And at that point, I started looking at Hattie McDaniel through a different lens. And I think that's part of the problem with so many people that have some kind of way about her, is we look at her through a 21st century lens. And once I took that off, I was able to see her for the legend that she is.
During that process, how long did it take you to
put this particular work together?
It took me almost 3 years because I really did a lot of research. I had to get off the internet because I discovered that a lot of the information on the internet was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to research libraries. I also did census records, read a whole lot of newspapers from back in the day. And so I did a lot of research, so much, in fact, that my girlfriend said, okay, you need to stop researching and go write the book.
Once you started writing the book, what were some of the things that really surprised you about Hattie McDaniel?
It really surprised me that she was a quiet warrior. You know, we're so used to our activists being loud and proud and power to the people, but Hattie was a quiet warrior. She brought about change because she had a seat at the table. For example, there are things that didn't make it into the movie, derogatory things that didn't make it into the Gone with the Wind movie, because Hattie McDaniel had them change. And she was able to do that because she had a seat at the table. And she was often criticized because people felt she wasn't doing enough for blacks. But so I was really surprised to see that, you know, the changes she was making. I also was stunned at the hate that she got from both sides. White people didn't like her because they thought Mammy was too sassy. Black people didn't like her because they thought she was too demeaning. And the NAACP waged an all-out war against her. So that really shocked me as well.
In reading the book, I was particularly pleasantly surprised. If it wasn't for her brother, Otis, we would not have known about Hattie McDaniel.
Right. I mean, Hattie's mother, a former slave,
right,
had her ready to go be a domestic, just like she was. But Otis had that entertainment bug, and he had his sister out performing when she was just 6 years old, and she always had that entertainment drive in her.
Why was it important for you to begin your narrative at the Academy Awards?
You know, I didn't want to do a cradle-to-grave story. I really wanted to do the moment that most people knew her for,
mm-hmm,
and then take you on a journey on all the things you didn't know.
Now, when you started the narrative, talk to us about Hattie McDaniel living in Denver, because I didn't know she grew up in Denver, and that's where her career started.
Right. A lot of people didn't know that Hattie McDaniel was the first black woman to ever have music on the radio. And so she had a thriving career in Denver. That's where the springboard happened. Everyone thinks she started in movies in Los Angeles, but she had built a long career before that.
Now, once she left Denver, talk to us about her moving to Los Angeles.
So her brother Sam and sister Etta were already there, and Sam was working on a show called The Optimistic Do-Nuts with Bing Crosby and some others. And so they told her, come on, we'll get you in entertainment. And she moved there, and she actually was in 70 unaccredited movies before Gone with the Wind. So everyone thinks that's what put her on the stage, but she had been toiling for about 8 years just trying to get into the industry.
Talk to us about her being a songwriter and a performer in the minstrel
shows. Right. So that's where she got her and her sister. That's where they got their start. They had the McDaniel sisters. They had a little a vaudeville show that they would do singing, dancing and skits. And Otis was their manager. He was the one always going around and putting the family to work. And it's just been in their blood. Their mother was a singer, but her dreams were squashed because you couldn't make money as a singer. And she became a domestic, and that's what she thought her children were destined to be. And they were like, nope, Mom, we're going to entertain.
Now, talk to us about some of her, I guess, her ride and die partners as she was navigating after the Academy Awards. Things didn't go the way that she thought they should have gone. But I think she had, saw something on Oprah and Gail. So she had a Gail Garros with her to help her navigate those waters.
Yeah, she was good friends with Louise Beavers and Lillian Randolph from Imitation of Life and It's a Wonderful Life. And really, those were her just ride-or-die girlfriends at the time, because she needed that. They, all three of them, were similar actresses, and they had similar hate. And so they bonded over that, along with Ruby Dandridge, who was Dorothy Dandridge's mother. And it was that core group of friends that helped her navigate the fact that her career didn't take off after the Oscars, which she had hoped for. Then she was also good friends with Clark Gable, Betty Davis. So she had a solid foundation of friends that helped her through the good and the bad times in Los Angeles.
Talk to us about her friendship with Clark Gable, because in your writings, he stood up for her, even though she didn't want to stand up for herself sometimes.
He did. And in fact, she had to rein him in sometimes. For example, the Atlanta premiere, they did a big event, and Hattie wasn't invited. So Clark Gable was like, well, I'm not going. And she had to say, you're the star, you're king of Hollywood, you can't do this, you have to go. But he was a very good friend to Hattie McDaniel, and vice versa.